Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn about some of the coolest science news, including new research on preserving fertility for cancer patients. First, today in Detroit, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump gave a speech outlining his economic plan for the nation. On Thursday, Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton will unveil her plan in a major address, also in Detroit. Trump laid out several tax and trade reforms, which he said would do great things for the United States.
The reforms I have outlined today are only the beginning. When we reform our tax, trade, energy, and regulatory policies, we will open a new chapter in American prosperity, which is so desperately needed. We need a new chapter.
David Wessel is with us to talk about Donald Trump's outline of a plan and to preview what Hillary Clinton's plan might look like. He's director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
Well, before we get to the what of the plan, let's start with the where. Both candidates this week unveiling their economic agendas in Detroit. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, isn't that a great coincidence? I think Detroit has become a symbol of all the weaknesses of the U.S. economy, a city that went bankrupt, that is shrinking, once had a lot of manufacturing jobs, and now doesn't. So I think both candidates are trying to say, in their own way, I want to restore the hardest hit parts of America to prosperity.
And let's talk about the trade side of his agenda. He said Trans-Pacific Partnership rejected, at least as currently stated, the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, renegotiated. He's talked pretty tough on trade in this campaign. What do you make of what he's saying about trade?
Well, I think a number of things come to mind. One is he's clearly challenging the orthodoxy of the Republican Party, which has long argued, as have many centrist Democrats, that trade hurts some people, but overall it's good for the economy. He doesn't seem to buy that. But secondly, I think he's identified a real anxiety among American workers that somehow we're getting a raw deal, and that the people who are hurt by trade, and some people are, the people who lose jobs because it's cheaper to make stuff overseas, have not been compensated. We economists pay a lot of lip service to how we're going to have compensation and adjustment assistance, but it hasn't been up for the task. And finally, I think he's pinpointing trade. He's accusing trade of things that have to do with a lot more changes in the economy than just globalization.
And he's accusing his opponent, Hillary Clinton, of being responsible for some of this. Here's a listen to what he had to say about Hillary Clinton and the TPP.
Hillary Clinton will never withdraw from TPP. She is bought, controlled, and paid for by her donors and special interests, 100%.
Now, this debate over trade in the United States goes back at least as far as Andrew Jackson and the tariff disputes of that time, probably before that. Why is this something that keeps coming up in American politics?
Well, I think that things are really different than they were in the 19th century when tariffs were really the way the government financed itself. And a lot of what went on in Congress was tension between people who bought imports and people who competed with imports. I think right now what's going on is pretty clear. We live in a very rapidly globalizing economy, and people feel that we've somehow lost control, and they assign to globalization all the problems of wage stagnation, of which we're all too familiar.
Is it right to assign that much blame to trade? Some people have said, well, part of the reason there are fewer manufacturing jobs is mechanization. One worker is so much more efficient now than they used to be thanks to recent technology.
Absolutely. Clearly, more than one thing's going on. A lot of stuff that has affected workers involves technology. But it's a lot easier to be angry at the Chinese than to be angry at your iPhone. And so I think it's easy to demonize immigrants, foreign companies, foreign countries, and that's what Trump is doing. And I think Hillary Clinton has had a hard time responding because Mr. Trump is correct. She has been part of this movement, and now she's trying to say, oh, I'll pull out of TPP, and people are saying, well, you know, you were against it now, but you were for it before, and they remember that Bill Clinton was against NAFTA and then implemented it.
Talking to David Wessel from the Brookings Institution, Donald Trump spoke on the economy today in Detroit. Hillary Clinton expected to speak on similar issues Thursday, also in Detroit. Moving away from trade, David, Donald Trump talked about things like cutting back on regulation, cutting taxes, simplifying the tax code. This sounds as much like normal Republican stuff as we've heard from Donald Trump lately, doesn't it?
Yes, but normal Republican stuff often involves cutting taxes, as he's proposed, and restraining government spending on various benefit programs like Medicare and Social Security. And so he's buying the tax cut agenda. In fact, he's essentially dropped his original tax plan and is now kind of embracing one that has been put together by House Republicans. But he, in contrast to Paul Ryan, expresses no interest and, in fact, criticizes the idea that we need to restrain spending on entitlements.
So what does that do if we're worried about annual budget deficits and the overall debt?
It means that Trump's plan, as he outlines it, would mean a massive increase in the federal debt. I don't have a number. There were some estimates about $9.5 trillion more debt over 10 years, but he's since modified his plan. But basically, his plan is to cut taxes for pretty much everybody who pays income taxes, which is about half the population. About 60% of the people pay income taxes, and not decrease at all the services we get from government. No cuts in the FBI, no cuts in Social Security or Medicare, no cuts in the national parks. Somehow he thinks he's going to get the allies to pay more of our defense bill. Well, if you collect less in revenue and you don't spend less in government programs, you're going to run up a huge debt, which is why this will never happen. And if it did, it would probably really hurt the American economy.
And Trump also announced a plan to make child care spending tax deductible, saying he's working on a plan with his daughter Ivanka and some economic experts. Who is this appeal pitched at, do you think?
Well, I think it's obviously a pitched at particularly working women, where we know he's vulnerable. That's Hillary Clinton has a lot more support among women. I think, you know, it's very appealing to say we're going to make it easier for people to pay for child care. There are no details here. And if all you do is make all child care expenses deductible, that would actually benefit upper income people and their nannies a lot more than the working poor who may not pay any income tax at all or who pay at a lower tax rate. So we don't really know what this plan is. I guess I would say that if I were trying to devise the wisest possible child care tax break, I probably would have somebody other than Ivanka Trump developing it, but we'll have to see what he comes up with.
We spent most of our time talking about Donald Trump and what he had to say today. Hillary Clinton, as we said, talking Thursday on the economy. What do we know about what she said about her economic plan so far?
Well, in contrast to Donald Trump, she has this very methodical way of saying, if I'm going to spend money on this, then I'm going to raise taxes on that. If I'm going to have a tax break here, I'm going to have a tax increase there. So her plan would not deal with our long-term debt problem at all, but it does prevent it from getting worse. That's the first thing. Secondly, she wants to use the tax code and the power of the government budget to reduce inequality in the U.S., to reduce the gap between those at the top and those at the bottom. That is not one of Mr. Trump's priorities, and his tax plan is, as best we can understand it, would be bigger tax breaks for people at the top. Both of them seem to have fallen in love with the idea of spending more money, federal money, on building infrastructure. He says he'd spend twice as much as her. I think she's going to develop some proposals this week, unless we're told, that might what incentives she'll provide to increase business investment, which has been a weak spot in our recovery. But I think she's going to try and answer his themes and say, I have the same goals as Donald Trump, more jobs, more growth, more prosperity, but I have a realistic way to do it, and he doesn't.
David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's David Wessel, director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institution. Joins us to talk about economic plans from Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton as they're being laid out in speeches this week. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, music affects people on a deep level. Different kinds of music affect us in very different ways. We'll find out about the science and psychology behind our love of music. Now, when a young person is diagnosed with cancer, there are lots and lots of options to consider, tough decisions to be made. One thing that might fall through the cracks is future fertility. Many people might not realize that chemotherapy and radiation treatments can compromise fertility, but new research is trying to create options for those women diagnosed with cancer who are hoping to have children in the future. Gemma Tarlak joins us now to talk about this and other stories from the world of science. She's a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to share cool science news. Gemma, welcome back.
Always good to be with you, Rob.
Well, let's start with that story I was just talking about, fertility for cancer patients. As I understand from a recent piece in Discover, there are options, a lot of them are some options out there for men, not so much for young women. Why not?
Yeah, well, you know, it all comes down to the plumbing, for want of a better way to put it. Male fertility preservation is pretty straightforward. If you're a young man, you just collect the sperm and you freeze it and you're good to go. It's a very straightforward and immediate process. For women, though, you have to be able to harvest mature eggs. That means the woman has to be a certain age, she has to be at a certain part of her cycle, and those eggs have to be retrieved surgically. It takes much longer, it's much more invasive, much more involved, and for a lot of young women who are diagnosed with an aggressive cancer, they don't have that kind of time. They need to be on that operating table within days of diagnosis. So researchers are looking at a way to make the process of preserving a young woman's fertility as quick and as easy and non-invasive, ideally, as it would be for a man.
Now, this is still in process, still in the works, but what is being tried right now?
Well, the most important thing is to be able to harvest the eggs before they're mature. So you want to be able to harvest immature eggs, to freeze them, and then to thaw them in a way that they are still 100% functional and can be used in vitro fertilization down the road. So right now the focus is really on how is it best to retrieve these immature follicles, these immature eggs, and to preserve them in a way that they can be reliably thawed out. And, you know, two of the ways they're exploring the thawing process is once they're thawed, you got to do something with them, and you don't want to reimplant them back in the woman's ovary, because you want to make sure that you're not introducing any cancerous cells. You want to make sure that the ovary itself hasn't been damaged to the point of being unusable, which happens a lot in chemotherapy. So really the cutting edge of this research is learning or figuring out how to grow these immature eggs once they're thawed outside of the body. So in a little lab setting, not a petri dish, because they tried petri dishes, that didn't work. So they've gone off on a completely different direction. That's really fascinating.
What is that new direction before we wrap up with this topic?
I am so glad you asked, because it involves ice cream thickener.
Ice cream thickener.
Yeah, there's a substance called alginate. It's based on, it's derived from algae, and it's most commonly used in ice cream thickeners today. However, scientists discovered that it is like the perfect growing medium in the lab for these immature eggs. So, you know, you can thank ice cream thickener for possibly giving young women a chance at being a mom after they've finished their cancer treatment.
That's amazing. Well, that's one we'll probably be watching for in the future, Gemma. Now, let's get into another topic that I know you're interested in, extinction. Now, we know, right, there have been mass extinctions throughout prehistory, right, every X number of tens of millions of years ago. Now we're thinking, what, there might be a pattern to this, and there might be an extraterrestrial, not alien species here, but a beyond-Earth explanation for it.
Yes, and you know, this is crazy, because this is a really fairly new field of research, and it was really only in the 1980s that we started to think that mass extinctions might be caused by something that comes from space. And if you remember, it was like around 82, 83 that people started talking about this enormous asteroid slamming into Earth, and it was about a decade later that they found the crater in the Gulf of Mexico, and it's only been really recently, in fact this summer, that they're drilling into it to figure out more about this asteroid. That is the asteroid that caused the mass extinction at the end Cretaceous, just about 66 million years ago, give or take.
That's the one that finished off dinosaurs and a lot of their close relatives.
Yeah, that's probably the most famous, although not the most devastating, mass extinction. And so the researchers started looking from different fields. They started looking at the mass extinctions we know about. There have been five major ones and several smaller level ones. We could tell by a dip in the kinds and abundance of fossils that we find in the fossil record. That's one of the ways of telling. So they started to think, okay, what if these have extraterrestrial causes? And they've developed, different researchers have developed different theories on something that is hitting us from space, something in space that is causing asteroids and comets to slam into us. And it's a contentious field, I have to say, because no one quite agrees on what it is or how often it happens. But there's a picture emerging that it really suggests there is a cyclical mass extinction going on. Not going on right now, thankfully.
So let's look at some of the culprits possible. And these, this again, this is still in the works. This is not, none of this is established for sure. But what are some of the, it's not even really theories at this point, what are some of the ideas about what might be throwing space stuff at us?
Yes, that's exactly it. Well, the oldest theory, which again goes back to the 1980s, is the nemesis theory. And that's that our sun has kind of like an evil twin. There's this companion star that's on this huge orbit that only swings through about every 26 million years. When it does, it stirs up comets, creates a lot of drama, and maybe that is what's causing it. And there are a couple other theories about causes within our solar system other than the nemesis theories. But right now, it looks like researchers are leaning more towards something outside our solar system. And the best way to look at it super quickly, if you think of the Milky Way, it's a spiral galaxy, you know, and it's those beautiful series of spirals all together, gorgeous to look at. Well, our sun and our solar system orbits the center of the Milky Way. So we're traveling at different points kind of through different neighborhoods of the Milky Way. And there are a lot of theories thinking that it's something about when we go into maybe like a rough neighborhood, literally, we open ourselves to attack because we've got comets, we've got other stuff, cosmic rays, maybe even dark matter that's just kind of slamming into us every so often.
That's pretty wild. So as we wiggle up, maybe, I don't know, north or up or whatever we want to call the direction from the plane of the Milky Way, maybe we're more prone to cosmic radiation, meteors, comets, something like that, or
absolutely,
or more dark matter?
Yeah, that's one of the theories, is that there's a special kind of dark matter. And the thing is, we have never been able to really detect dark matter, which makes up as much as 85% of the universe. It's still theoretical, and now they're theorizing there may be an even more theoretical special kind of dark matter that arranges itself in a really tight disk that at the center of the galaxy that just really messes up. And again, since things like comets and rocks flinging our way, other researchers think that dark matter, knots of it kind of sprinkled throughout the galaxy, as we pass through them, it may actually cause the core of the Earth to heat to catastrophic levels. So even within the dark matter camp, there are several different theories about how it could really ruin our day.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak with some inspiring news from Discover Magazine. Our monthly look at some of the most interesting stories from the world of science. Now, another one you're a fan of, archaeology, an amazing Neolithic site in Turkey. It's had over 50 years of work done on it. Tell us about this.
Yeah, and you know, excavations are wrapping up right as we speak in the settlement of Çatalhöyük. My apologies to any native Turkish speakers. It's not my, not my language.
I couldn't do any better.
And basically, over the half century, especially the last 25 years, they have found that this city, that it's more than 10,000 years old. And at its peak, 8,000 people lived there. It's huge. It's 34 acres. And they are finding incredible finds, an incredible assemblage of fossils from that period, but also just artifacts, absolutely gorgeous murals and bucrania, which is when you use animal horns decoratively. And the more they discover about this society, which left no written record of itself, the more they're finding really interesting, challenging ideas that really shake up our notion of prehistory.
Well, one of the most interesting things is it seems like an incredible sequence over 2,000 years, and they're trying to pin it down to neighborhoods and generations where they can really get an up-close look at how things changed over time.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about this site. It's so concentrated and so well dated using a few different ways, using radiocarbon dating, but also using stratigraphy, which is really looking at the layers and assuming the lower layer is the oldest. They're using a bunch of different methods and combining them all together to be able to say, okay, these people lived in this house at this time, and their next-door neighbors were of their same generation, or their next-door neighbors were actually of their grandparents', you know, generation. They're really able to nail down the date, and that is important for understanding the artifacts as well as the burials, because in this place, most people were buried beneath their homes. So there's just a wealth of information in a single house.
A couple interesting things. It looks like for a couple thousand years, this is pretty egalitarian, not any really obvious social hierarchy here.
That's correct. There was no like religious center or giant plaza or, you know, priestly house. Everything is pretty much, it's kind of like IKEA, you know, everything is equal. And actually, one of the interesting things they think that may have been enforced, like it may have been enforced equality. And that's because they find a pattern of skull fractures that suggests people may have been like conked over the head when they got out of line. So there's all different really interesting ways of looking at the society, but it's definitely not what we expected to find 10,000 years ago.
Yeah, this injury, it's usually what they think is a non-fatal bump on the head.
Right, exactly. And they think that may have been a way of like keeping people in line. You know, if you step out of line, if you get too big for your britches or try to have more cows than your neighbor, then maybe we conk you on the head with a rock. That's one theory. I want to stress that's one theory at this
right.
time. It's not carved in stone, so to speak.
And so they're finishing up, you said, this dig here. And then what? They've got 50 years worth of data on a 3,000+ year time period from this thing 10,000 years old. So we're going to be crunching this information for quite a while, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the active research was continuing through the summer, and they're still doing things like drilling sediment cores to get a better idea of how the vegetation changed over that period. They're still doing a lot of active research now in the field, and now they're going to bring it into the lab, and they found so much material. We're going to be hearing new findings coming out of here for years, if not decades.
Briefly, Gemma, do you ever wish you could just hop in a time machine and just go back and look? I do.
No.
That'd be awesome.
You know, because that's kind of spoiling the mystery.
Oh,
that's like
okay.
reading the last page of a mystery novel.
All right, you're no fun. Gemma, you are a lot of fun. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us about once a month to share some of the coolest news from the world of science. Coming up after the news, when you need to get pumped up, do you put on Metallica or Mozart? How about when you want to relax and calm down? What do you listen to then? We're going to talk to this guy. He's a scientist and he's a musician, and he's written a new book about how music affects us and why, some of the science and psychology behind it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to two investigative journalists about how problems with water quality in Wisconsin will affect fall elections here in the state. First, if this acoustic version of Birdland agrees with you, that might say something not just about your taste in music, but about your personality as well. Scientist and musician John Powell holds a PhD in physics from Imperial College at London University and a master's degree in music from the University of Sheffield in Great Britain. He's the author of the book How Music Works, and his new book is Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sound. John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Oh, hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, are we wired to appreciate music of some sort or another as humans?
Generally, yes. Thankfully, most of us are. There are a few people who are genuinely tone-deaf, who can't tell whether a tune's going up or down. But that's only about 3% of the population. The rest of us, if you think about your body having a sort of internal pharmacy, which dispenses various chemicals to make you run away from danger or go to sleep, then music has the key to the pharmacy. It can actually help dispense these chemicals when they're required, or stop ones that, if you're having trouble sleeping, for example, you've got too much of a chemical called noradrenaline in your system, and just listening to classical music quietly before you go to bed can stop that problem and cure insomnia.
Huh. Now, just because we are wired, most of us, to appreciate music doesn't mean we'll like any and all kinds of music. What kind of things, and this is a lot about what your book's about, what kind of things determine what kind of music I like versus what kind of music John Powell likes?
Well, we might like the same stuff. We can't tell.
Could be.
But, we could tell if we've met. Yes, by the 1990s, psychologists had come to the conclusion that there were five or maybe six personality traits which you can actually reliably measure. These are conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism, and openness, which is also could be called culture or intellect. And the idea is that there's a sixth one, which is a combination of honesty and humility as well. And the idea is that if you grade yourself on these five or six different characteristics, you can get a rough approximation of your personality. And some psychologists have linked various personalities to various sorts of music. And to do this, they had to classify music into a very small number of titles. So we have reflective and complex music, which includes classical, jazz, folk, and blues. Intense and rebellious music is like rock and alternative and heavy metal. Upbeat and conventional music is pop, country and western, soundtracks and religious music. And finally, energetic and rhythmic music is stuff like rap and soul and electronic. So, it's been found that enthusiasts for reflective and complex music tend to score high on intelligence, but they're very poor at sports. They're good with work, good with words, sorry, and they're often politically towards the left. Fans of intense and rebellious music are also good on intelligence and they're skilled with words, but they're usually good at sports.
And there are exceptions. There are exceptions here, right, John? Like, I like
absolutely
loud, raucous music, and I'm not what I would say good at sports exactly. So not everybody's fitting these cookie cutter categories.
No. This is a very general, broad brush thing. But you know, one of the interesting things here is that you can classify the music together into these broad genres. So if you do like, if you like rock, you're probably going to like alternative music as well. And if you like country and western, you probably like pop music and soundtracks as well. So there's an opportunity here to expand your taste in music.
Interesting. So if you like that, you might like the other, and it might fit well. Another thing you write about, and we've talked about some on the show before, is when we fix our musical taste, we tend to lock in at some point in our lives, and it can be hard to break out of that category. When do we tend to decide this is good music, and anything after that is the awful stuff that the kids listen to these days?
Well, the strange thing here is that we lock into a lot of things between the ages of about 15 and 25, and music's one of those things. But we also choose the sort of books we like reading, and even the sort of toothpaste we use, which is very strange, but we tend to fall madly in love with certain sorts of music when we're in our late teens, and we retain that love, even though quite often later on in life our tastes change because we get a craving for more complicated music as we get older, simply because the stuff that we listened to when we were younger, we know so much about the genre that we can forecast what's going to happen next in the music, and it gets a bit dull for us. So you do find that some people who loved punk or heavy rock when they were 18, 19, by the time they're 45, they're listening to jazz and Beethoven. But we do retain that deep affection for the stuff that we fell in love with when we were approximately 20.
We're talking to John Powell. His new book is Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sound. I want to get into some music and the impact it has on people. I want to start by listening to a little Barry Manilow.
I remember all my life, raining down as cold as ice.
And John, a lot of people love Barry Manilow, so I apologize to them now. You write about this as an example of music used in New Zealand, I think, and elsewhere to drive young people away from loitering.
Yes, this is in Sydney,
in Australia,
in 2006. And what happened was, in that year, they had the city council had a lot of trouble with teenagers hanging around shopping malls. They weren't doing anything illegal, they were just hanging around. But the people who were trying to do the shopping found them a bit sort of in the way. And the city councillors tried various ways of getting rid of them. They tried getting the uniformed guards to ask them to move along, but of course they weren't doing anything wrong, so why should they? They stay where they were. And then somebody had the brilliant idea of making the environment very uncool for teenagers. And these teenagers were all born in about 1990. So the most uncool music they could think of was Barry Manilow. And they started playing Barry Manilow through the speakers in the shopping malls, and the teenagers just evaporated. They disappeared within minutes and never came back. And this is because we all want to be cool. I want to be cool. You want to be cool. Because cool is just a shorthand word for how much acceptance you have with your peer group. But once you get above about 25, you're quite confident with the coolness you have, and you don't feel polluted by things that happen around you. But when you're trying to establish your level of cool, when you're 16, 17, 18, if anything uncool happens around you, you feel like it's going to contaminate your own cool.
Wow.
So you run away from it.
So mom and dad music has a contagion effect on me.
That's right, yeah. So being in an uncool place makes you less cool, and so the kids involved just disappeared. And it's a really good example of the power that music can have on our behavior.
Let's play some other examples. Here's one. I think people loved it. I think it probably got uncool too, but here's Bobby McFerrin.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry.
So don't worry. Be happy, and that's the effect it had on a lot of people. Why can some music like that Bobby McFerrin song, John, perk us up, make us happy?
Well, as I was saying earlier about this inner pharmacy that you have, there are all sorts of, we can call them drugs if you like adrenaline and cortisol, serotonin and so on. And if you really like a piece of music and it makes you happy, and in that case the lyrics are very happy as well, and it's rather a relaxed piece of music as well, and you can't be denied by anybody that it has a happy feel to it, then your blood supply starts getting more serotonin and dopamine into it, which is your happiness drugs. And so that will have a lot of people who are just familiar with Western music, that particular track will make them feel happier in a genuine way. I mean, you can actually take blood tests of people and see that their blood chemistry is changing with the music. If you put something a lot more driving on, if you're falling asleep on a motorway, for example, and you put something really intense and driving on the stereo, you can give yourself a hit of adrenaline, and that will wake you up and make you pay more attention to what you're doing. And it's a genuine chemical change brought on by music.
I'm going to get a little personal here and play a clip of a song by a TV on the radio, Halfway Home. I'm going to point out a moment during it that I'll describe the emotional response I have to it. So first, the song, TV on the Radio. Here it comes. So, John, at that moment, and I still have this, even though I know it's coming, I tear up a little at that chord change. It hit me powerfully for a while, less so now. What the heck's happening in my brain there?
Well, something emotional must have happened in your life when you first heard it.
I was in the kitchen cooking, I think. Nothing big.
Well, I'm surprised. If that was the first time you heard it, I'm surprised, because when you hear a piece of music for the first time, you don't generally get the full emotional effect. It's usually a bit later. But we all get these emotional climaxes from changes in harmony rather than changes in the tune. And it's usually a subtle change that we didn't really expect. It was something better than we expected. And whenever in life, if we ever get anything better than we expected, we give ourselves a reward chemical, dopamine and serotonin, which says, oh, that was really good, we want to do that again. And that's why you retain the same, even though you now know it's coming. The first time it happened, it really gave you a big emotional response. But it's a sort of pleasure response you're given for having done something good to yourself. So it's a bit like the pleasure response you might get from being given a sandwich, because the sandwiches are obviously useful. But you also get a pleasure response when you're handed a sandwich, 10 years later, because you know the sandwich is going to give you this pleasure response. The same with music. You don't need to be just surprised to get the pleasure response. You can get the pleasure response because you know it's coming. And as you were just saying then on the radio, you were saying, here it comes, here it comes. Well, actually, your body, that's what your mind is doing before that happens.
It's a tasty brain sandwich.
Yeah, basically, yes. Your brain is designed to reward you if you have it. The first time you eat a sandwich, to tell you this is a good thing. But after that, your brain has this sort of pre-wired thing which says, a sandwich is coming up, this is going to be a good thing. And so if the music hit you in that way the first time around, then after that you get this, the same pleasure response, but it's slightly earlier, and it's because it's coming up.
We're talking to John Powell right now. Watch for our new band, Tasty Brain Sandwich, in a club near you. His most recent book is Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sound. We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Do you find that you gravitate toward certain types of music all the time, or maybe in certain situations, something to get you pumped up, something to calm you down? Are you aware of that impact that music can have on you? Is there a particular song you associate with a powerful moment in your life? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to John Powell. His most recent book is called Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sound. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What music really speaks to you? Are you committed to one genre, one particular artist? Is there a song that has a strong emotional impact on you, for better or worse? Why? Was it associated with, I don't know, a scene from real life or a scene from a movie? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Rich on the line in Two Rivers. Rich, hi.
Hi. I found a song a long time ago. Actually, William Orbit did a remake of Adeco. It was it's all strings, it's all violins, and your guest speaker might have heard of it, but it is so intense. I mean, it builds, and it used to be like this. They played it for the Elephant movie during the saddest moments when he was dying. And I heard it like all the other day again on YouTube, and I started playing it for friends, and they all agree that it's like the most beautiful piece, and it just touches your soul every time they hear it.
And you get an intense feeling when you hear it, Rich?
Man, I'm not even a crying guy. I do hospice care.
Oh, wow.
And I hear it, and when I hear it, it's like this, when the violins come to that peak, and it goes doom, doom, and then they back off. And when they come to that peak, I had friends all hear it, and they all cry at that.
Wow. Rich, thank you so much for sharing that experience. And John, music as a movie cue, it can have that powerful, often very sad feeling to it.
Yeah, so film music can be very, very powerful because you have the impact of the visuals and the music at the same time. You could look at it this way, that the film provides you a sequence of events to get emotional about, and the music heightens all those emotions. And one strange thing is that you can actually get a bigger emotional effect if you play the wrong music before a climactic event. So that if you're watching a father looking for a child and the music's happy, and then the guy turns a corner and he finds that his child hasn't survived whatever it was, then the shock is much more basic and visceral. And similarly, if you've got some menacing music going on while he's looking for his child, and then suddenly the child's okay, then the relief is much greater.
Hmm.
So movie composers actually play these tricks on us quite often, where they send us one way, and in fact, the result is completely different, and it's quite a shock when you get that effect.
Rich, thanks so much for sharing that. Speaking of strings with a powerful impact, here's a very different use of strings in a momentous movie scene. Here's a listen. So the strings in Psycho, that's not the freakiest part of them there, but John, that's one that lives on in the memory and not in a, like, that's a get your heart beating in a bad way sort of thing.
Yeah, that's right. The strange thing that happened with that one is that Hitchcock told the composer, Bernard Herrmann, not to write any music for that scene, but Bernard Herrmann ignored him and wrote some, and it's become the most iconic piece of film there ever been. If your listeners don't know the bit, I can't really sing, but he goes, ee.
Right.
I get stabbed in the shower.
It's like scraping a chalkboard with a violin.
Exactly, yeah. He was trying to imitate the sound of human screaming, and he did a very good job with it. But the thing is that piece of music, that the ee scream bit, is so iconic now that in the film Finding Nemo, they used that music for the little girl Darla, who was a great danger to the,
right.
the fish involved. She's only a little kid, but she's dangerous to them. So whenever she appears, you get the EEE music to say, this is a point of danger.
We're talking to John Powell about the emotional power of music. We'll go back to our callers now with Brad in Portage. Brad, hi.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I was just curious, as far as classical music goes, I've noticed with a lot of the, maybe a child's swing or items like that are made meant for a little more of entertainment. They always have classical music options to be able to play as the swing moves back and forth. And I was wondering if that had more to do with the soothing effects of classical music or if it was more in relation to if small children listen to classical music, they tend to have higher IQs when they grow up.
Brad, thanks for the call. So, yeah, classical music on kids' toys or kids' videos, things like that, is that something that actually calms kids not down, John, or is this kind of an aspirational thing? Well, if they're listening to Mozart, their IQ will go up.
Well, there is a thing called the Mozart effect, which was published a while ago, and it does exist, but it has nothing to do with Mozart. It was misnamed. Basically, if you're about to do an IQ test and you do something which is A, pleasant, and B, slightly stimulating, like listening to a piece of happy piano music, then your IQ will rise because it stops you being sleepy, so you wouldn't... If you're sleepy before an IQ test, you're going to do badly, and if you're panicky, you're going to do badly. So if you do something nice, which is also slightly stimulating, you'll get your best score. And so they've investigated this, and while they were looking into it from the Mozart effect, they also found a Schubert effect and a Blur effect even, and even a Stephen King effect, because if you listen to a short story by Stephen King just before an IQ test, you also get a better score because you're slightly stimulated and you've enjoyed it.
Interesting. Thanks for the call, Brad. We'll go next to Tony in Manistique. Tony, hi.
Hi there, how are you guys?
Good. What's your music story, Tony?
Well, my music story is I'm a child of the 70s and grew up listening to a lot of 70s music. And every time I hear the music these days, it brings back real vivid memories. I'm talking about almost like a film, a screen going past my mind, and I'm placing myself at those points. Is there any research that really plays upon that?
Yeah, yes, there's quite a lot of research onto this. It's generally stuff from when you were 18, 19, 20, 21 perhaps. I imagine this is the sort of period you're thinking about. And that is the time at which we start developing our own personalities. We start deciding what we want to read and what we want to write. What we want to listen to and so on. So you create your own personality at that point, and you have a lot of great memories because a lot of things happen for the first time. You have your first drink, you have your first kiss and so on. And so there are a lot of very big, important memories from that time. And also, you've fallen in love with the music that you've helped create your own personality. I mean, if you were born in 1750 or 1810 and your parents were farmers or fishermen, there was no need to create a personality for yourself because that's what you were going to be. And everyone knew where you would be living and what you'd be doing in 40 years' time. But nowadays, we have so many choices in life that we genuinely have to create ourselves, and we do that in our late teenage years with the help of our peer group. And part of that building process, and part of one of the things we use, is the music that our peer group love. So you get together with a gang of people who are your friends, obviously, and you choose a certain genre of music, and that's yours. And you might choose a certain band, and it can be a big disappointment if that band become mainstream during the time that you're enjoying them, because they're your band. But yes, you do identify very strongly with stuff from that sort of teenage years.
Tony, thanks for the call. As we wrap up, John, and briefly, I never want to be the person who says, oh, there's no new good music out these days, because I know there is. So are there lessons in how we can keep our minds open to the new stuff that's coming out and genuinely appreciate it?
Absolutely. If you pick a genre, any genre, you might pick Indian Bhangra music, it doesn't really matter. If you listen to it while you're doing the washing up or while you're driving the car and give it a few hours, just pick one CD or one playlist and play it 10 times to yourself, you'll start learning the rules of that particular piece of music. It's like learning a different language. It does take about 10 times, as I say, but then you'll start really appreciating it because you need to have a certain knowledge of what's likely to be happening next if we start enjoying a new genre of music. But you could pick bluegrass banjo or brass band music, and you will almost certainly start to love it, and that will broaden your horizons musically.
And what are you discovering these days, John?
I'm still working my way through all the world music in the world. There's a lot of it.
All right.
But African acoustic music is something I'm looking at the moment. It's really beautiful stuff. You have to play, you have to work at it for the first few hours, but after that, it really is beautiful.
Fantastic advice. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me on.
We've been talking to scientist and musician John Powell. He's the author of the book Why You Love Music, From Mozart to Metallica, The Emotional Power of Beautiful Sound. And you can keep telling us your stories, what music you look back on with good memories, fondness, intense memories, or what you're discovering now at whatever age. Do that at the Central Time Facebook page. In the village of Celeron, New York, there's a new statue of Lucille Ball. No surprise, the actress and comedian is from there. There usually wouldn't be anything newsworthy about a memorial statue of her, if it weren't for the old statue. The previous Lucy sculpture in Celeron, New York, got a lot of criticism for not really looking much like Lucille Ball. In fact, for looking just a little bit frightening. Frightening enough that residents and critics around the world started calling it Scary Lucy. Now, a new sculptor has had another go at it. As of this weekend, the two statues were side by side in Celeron, New York. Have a look. We have a picture and a link on the Central Time Facebook page. Pull them up. See them side by side. Do they look just a little bit different? Does the new one look better? You make the call. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.